Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Today is January 12, 2012, and thank you so much for listening to these free, informative broadcasts. You can become a part of this educational movement. Simply tell your friends to listen to the show. Send them an email with a link. Tweet the show on Twitter. There are just buttons right on the show page, post via the share buttons onto your Facebook, Dig, StumbleUpon, Reddit, MySpace, or copy the embed code of the show for your website or blog. Favorite the show and become a regular listener, and you can also click the reminder button. Wow, they give you every opportunity to listen via the Blog Talk Radio. And so you can also contact us individually. For some reason, we're getting a little bit of clicks in the background today. So you can contact Alan via email or visit his website. And you can contact me, and I will forward the information to him directly. Let's see what else we need to tell. Well, I want to tell you, Alan, I am so thrilled to be back on the air with you. And as the intro music was playing, I was tapping my foot and really bouncing to the music because you are an incredible musician, composer, and lyricist.
Well, that's very kind of you, Debbie. I appreciate that. It's delightful to have you back. Every bit as happy to have you here as you are to be back. So hope your holidays were great, and sorry we had technical problems that kept you out last week, but delighted to have you back as well. Lots okay. to talk about, as always, here.
Okay. We're going to introduce today's program with a quote. Is that correct?
Sure.
All right. The Buddha stated, three things cannot be long hidden. What are they, Alan?
And according to the Buddha, the sun, the moon, and the truth.
They will shine, won't they?
They will. And I think this is a reference to cycles, not only the celestial cycles of planets and moons and stars, for that matter, that cycle around the center of a galaxy, but many other things run cycles, too. And I find this really encouraging because we don't think of truth as running in cycles. We think of truth as something that is either exposed or not, I guess, in the simpler terms with regard to the vaccine issue. But I took that quote from the Buddha a step further because when we look at the vaccine issue, those who believe that it is not truth that is underlying current vaccine policy and law are frustrated that our attempts to get that truth out are exceedingly difficult. There are people who have been working on this issue for literally decades, and I feel that we're making some progress, but we feel Debbie, am I still on? Are you still there? Okay, we seem to be having a technical difficulty here. I don't know. It looks like from... Okay, Debbie, are you there?
Yes, I am. I signed out because there was constant clicks, and I'm still getting them. I don't know why.
Okay, I'm not hearing it on this end, so hopefully
Okay, so were you continuing to speak as even when I signed out?
Well, I had an error message come up on my screen, and so I wasn't sure who was in or not, but I see what has happened now, so we can continue.
Okay, I'm getting a lot of clicks every second, so I don't know what that is. All right.
Okay, I'm not hearing them, so let's assume, and maybe
it's
somebody...
It's just mine.
If we can open up the chat, maybe the listener can tell us if they're hearing it.
Okay.
So
go ahead and tell us your interpretation once again of the sun, the moon, and the truth as something that is cannot be hidden.
Yes, that's the Buddha statement that three things cannot long be hidden: the sun, the moon, and the truth. And with regard to the vaccine issue, I was just commenting that many people have been working on this issue in some cases for decades, and are very frustrated at the slow rate the slow pace in terms of the ultimate goal of full transparency on the underlying corruption, conflicts of interest, suppression of competing views and information and so forth. And we don't all often think of the truth as something that cycles. And I think the Buddha is telling us that, yes, that is also something that is subject to cycles. And so with that in mind, I've added to the Buddha statement with regard to the vaccine issue. We go forward not dissuaded by the odds against us, but rather confident in the knowledge that complete transparency is necessarily the eventual outcome. And that falls from this idea that perhaps it's an unavoidable consequence, outcome or consequence of the suppression of truth is that in cyclical form the truth will come out. In any event, when we look at the... financing of those who have an opposing agenda to keep the truth suppressed, to control information, and to control people as a consequence of that, we can easily feel overwhelmed because we are up against some pretty powerful people and companies. But
okay, so let's give the folks just a heads up, like a preemptive of what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking about Dr. Andrew Wakefield's files, the defamation lawsuit that's going on in the Texas court for January 3rd, 2012. And there was also a huge article on Natural News regarding the libel that was perpetrated against him, and he is fighting back. And then you have GSK Lab is fined over vaccines tested that killed 14 babies. And this is in the Buenos Aires Herald from 2011, you have written. And also, I don't know whether you're aware that there's a big activity going on about the vaccines in India that have five different components to them, and also little babies are being killed and the parents are being suppressed from speaking out. And then you have the FDA warns Novartis of violations at three plants. And I don't know if we're going to be able to cover all of the other things. You've got details of labs made bird flu that won't be revealed. So that sounds very, very interesting. And this morning I woke up and my husband told me that if you've gotten the swine flu shot already, whatever bug is going around now is not covered in that vaccine. So it's not going to do you any good to have it. That's as far as we got so far.
Yeah, the World Health Organization said months ago that the swine flu had run its course, it had come and gone, and so the only reason I can see for getting a swine flu vaccine anywhere at all at this point is to use up the vaccines that haven't expired yet. I'm not sure.
Yeah, just get rid of it and put it in our body. Dr. Bob has said to CNN this morning, a new strain of H1N1 swine flu has been detected in the Midwest. 200 cases have been discovered, none of them seriously, but the vaccine from 2011 and 2012 does not work against it.
Yeah, there was an article several months ago talking about somebody taking a different approach in terms of how they developed the vaccine, so they would come up with something that would address all flu strains. And I don't have the scientific training to explain to you what the difference or how the approach was different, but there was a different way that they were approaching the development so that they were targeting something that's common to all flu vaccines as opposed to having to do something that is addressing only one vaccine at a time, and therefore they have to keep producing different ones. Of course, you can make more money if you target it to individual strains and have to keep making different vaccines for different strains. But anyway, yes, a lot of things to talk about. So we'll talk a little bit about all of these, and so we can, or as many of these as we have time to get to, so that we can have some discussion without getting too far into any one topic. But I'll let people know that all of these topics we're talking about today, and this is usually the case when we're talking about news items here on homeopathyworldcommunity.com with the Vaccines and Your Rights show, come from articles that are linked at the Pandemic Response Project news page. The website is pandemicresponseproject.com, and then there are links across the top. The news page link is on the far right of all the pages in that site. Articles are added on almost, if not literally, a daily basis from around the world. To really understand better what's going on in the vaccine arena, it is immensely helpful to have an international perspective, because there's a lot of things that do not reach the news here in the United States. You really need to look beneath the surface to alternative news sources and to international news sources to get the full picture. But we see overall a fairly consistent story with vaccines in the broad general sense overall. But let's talk a little bit about Andrew Wakefield, just a real very brief recap, because this is a story that's been going on for a period of years now. Andrew Wakefield was a medical doctor in England, I think a gastroenterologist. But in any case, he and some other doctors were working with a dozen child patients. And he was one of the authors of a paper published in The Lancet, which I believe is a British medical journal, back in 1998, which dared, I say with a little sarcastic twinge in my voice here, which dared to suggest that some of the problems these children were having might have been connected with the MMR vaccine, because they found strains of, I think it was measles virus, in these children's guts, most of the children's guts, that was clearly the vaccine strain and not a live wild virus. But it's really important to understand that Dr. Wakefield at that time and in that paper was not taking, by any stretch of the imagination, an anti-vaccine approach. He was merely suggesting that maybe the vaccines need to be separated instead of all in one shot, which you would think would excite the pharmaceutical community, because then they could, I guess we have to do three separate shots and we can make that much more money. Maybe it is more cost-effective for them to combine them. I don't really know that side of the story. But in any event, he wasn't being at all anti-vaccine. He was saying maybe these vaccines need to be separated and there should be more research done on this. But I think at this point, having heard to a significant extent both sides of this issue as it's played out over time, I think the problem from the pharmaceutical industry point of view was that the mere suggestion of more research was something that needed to be nipped in the bud, because if more research continued, then that would risk opening the door to the reality of increasingly about the problems with vaccines, the connections between vaccines and autism, for example, which, by the way, has been established. We could maybe do a whole show on that at some point, but it's been established but suppressed. And anyone's welcome to email me for more information on that if they'd like. But we'll have to come back to that one. But in any case, he wasn't saying that vaccines cause autism. What he did was raise a question about possible further research looking into that question. And he was viciously attacked by a gentleman by the name of Brian Deere, a journalist. He's been accused over and over again over a period of years of having falsified data, manipulated data, and so forth. He eventually went up before the, I believe it's called the General Medical Council, which is the entity that licenses physicians in the UK. And he and another doctor ultimately lost their licenses.
So you know, if you have lost your license, then you lost your career path that you've devoted your whole life to studying, I can't imagine that that would have been would be worth millions upon millions of dollars for a physician.
Well, it seems to me, even if they felt like, well, first of all, there have been several studies subsequent to the one Dr. Wakefield was involved with that have confirmed and verified his findings. You would think that alone would exonerate him, but it did not do that. He has, in very recent years, been living in Texas. Living in Texas, in or near Austin.
Oh, okay.
I mean, he still has a medical degree. He just doesn't have a medical license. I don't know if he has sought or could seek.
But I didn't realize he was living in the United States.
Yes, yes. So he's been in the U.S. for a little while. So he filed a defamation lawsuit in Texas, in a Texas state court.
Okay.
Apparently, in early 2011, the British Medical Journal, not being willing to let this issue go, they had an article by the same journalist, Brian Deere. I say the word journalist with some hesitation because having watched, and I recommend, a two-hour interview of Dr. Wakefield by Dr. Joseph Mercola. You can find that on Mercola.com. Do a search for Wakefield and pull up that YouTube or video interview and watch that. It's quite revealing. Dr. Wakefield explains exactly what happened, how and why. And I just, honestly, I just don't believe the guy has done anything wrong or bad. I believe he's been the victim of a witch hunt. So, of course, so do many other people in the alternative vaccine community. But he's been ridiculed and chastised not only in the UK but on American mainstream television as well. I've been really disappointed to see how they carry that. But they don't mention a thing, for example, about Paul Thorson, who was indicted on 13 counts of fraud with the CDC. That sort of thing just falls under the radar. We're not going to bother to mention that happening right here in the U.S., but when some guy overseas loses his license on what ultimately is probably just a witch hunt, that gets blasted all over the news. Anyway, the British Medical Journal ran an article January last year, again criticizing Dr. Wakefield and using some very strong language. Let me find real quick here the quote, if I can.
And I provided the link for anyone who is listening live today to this document, which is the plaintiff's original petition to the court in Travis County, Texas. It is Dr. Andrew J. Wakefield to the British versus, I guess, the British Medical Journal and the British Medical Journal Publishing Group, including Brian Deere individually and Dr. Fiona Godley individually. So I don't understand really the legal aspects of how this all works, how you can pinpoint particular individuals within an organization in a, when you call it a plaintiff's original petition. What does that mean?
Well, it boils down to this. The British Medical Journal published an article accusing Dr. Wakefield of fraud and other things, making false statements, according to Dr. Wakefield, of course. And the author of the article was Brian Deere, so a journalist, and so he, the individual, is asserting this. So he's a defendant. The British Medical Journal published it, so the journal is a defendant. And the primary editor, Fiona, what's the?
Godley.
Godley, thank you. Also added her own personal statements to this as well. And so the three of them then are defendants here. But one piece here.
Can you say exactly what is he trying to do with this petition? Is it a court case?
This is a lawsuit. He's filed a lawsuit. He'll be seeking money damages. The complaint here does not specify the damages, but I bet they're going to be big numbers.
Yeah.
Because the damage to his career by these statements is potentially profound. Now, I don't know whether or not
his reputation, his name, the years that he's been waded through the mud.
Hang on for a second, because this complaint is based on something that happened a year ago.
Okay.
And while the law varies from state to state, defamation can include usually has a short statute of limitations. You usually have typically have a year, and apparently that's the case here in Texas. It is here in North Carolina the same. You have a year after the act occurred to file, or it's too late to file. So they're complaining about statements that showed up just under a year ago. Well, now a little over a year ago, but at the time it was filed, it was just under a year ago. They got in just under the line for the statute of limitations in Texas, from what I understand. That showed up in January 2011 in the British Medical Journal. So they were basically accusing Wakefield of fraud. Now, whether or not the damages that he can sue for would extend back in time to the whole series of events, I'm not clear off the top of my head, but at minimum, they're going to be claiming damages from this information, what he, of course, claims was very deliberate and malicious. Not only was it inaccurate, but and if it's true that it's inaccurate, and my understanding, of course, having followed this case over the last couple or few years, is that it's blatantly false. And because they're attacking him professionally, it's libel per se. Defamation is sort of an umbrella term that includes both slander, which is spoken words, and libel, which is written or broadcast words that are impugning someone's reputation, basically false statements about a person to any third party is potentially defamation, either libel or slander, or sometimes both, depending on the specific character of the communication. But in any event,
well, thank you for clarifying that and correcting me. Because this is important. So if you're looking at the document, you see who the persons are that are involved in the case. They start off that way,
right?
And then the next thing, when you scroll down. The thing about it is my screen bounces around. Part two, what is that? The discovery level, and then the parties
Let me just summarize, because for purposes today, I don't want to get too bogged down into the sort of legal technicalities. But this is a petition that starts a lawsuit. Here in North Carolina, they would call it a complaint. It may have different terms and different rules and so forth in different states, and different from states to federal court cases and so forth. But this is a state lawsuit. And in order for a lawsuit to proceed, there are going to be very specific rules about certain kinds of content that have to be in the petition. It's not just a statement of the facts. You have to establish jurisdiction. And there may be other rules, again, from district to district or state to state or jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So the information that's in here is all information that is required by the state of Texas in order to establish grounds for a lawsuit that would enable the lawsuit to go forward. If you don't have a properly drafted petition or complaint, then the lawsuit doesn't go forward. And so there is a section in here, if you scroll through several pages, it's section number four that begins on,
I think.
The third. It says the facts. And
right.
This really gets more to sort of the nitty-gritty as far as most of us are going to be concerned with what actually happened. And this is a section I encourage people to scroll through down to if they follow the link and look at this actual petition, which is posted online. And you'll get a good, quick overview. It won't be the complete set of facts, but it will be a good overview of what Dr. Wakefield is claiming has been said about him, that it's false, that it is malicious, and so forth. So it will be interesting to see. Of course, the
falsification of data is, I think, a pretty important point in there.
They're accusing him of having falsified data in the 1998 study, and he adamantly insists and has all along that he didn't falsify anything. He followed all the proper procedures.
Mm-hmm.
He worked with several other doctors in this process, and I'm not entirely sure why he's the one that seems to be the primary scapegoat here, although he certainly had a lead role in the research, as I understand it. But the good news here is this, that he's been viciously attacked in the past. He lost his license. He's lost his country, basically. He has taken major, major hits here. And not only him, though, because by making an example of him for daring to challenge or even suggest a challenge to vaccines, because he didn't really challenge vaccines, he just suggested further research that might or might not result in raising any concerns about vaccines. That was a message sent to the entire international medical research community that this is taboo. You do not go there with your research. And so what's at stake here is far more than the demise of one man's career. This is a huge issue. So if this case in Texas goes forward successfully, and there's certainly, in my opinion, from what I've seen following the issue, grounds for it to do so, this could be a tremendous win, not just for Dr. Wakefield personally, but for the larger vaccine awareness community and therefore the entire planet. Because if he's successful with this and we can bring to light the fact that everything that happened to him was a big charade, big cover-up, we expose some of the underlying corruption that is status quo today in the pharmaceutical industry and in the medical community. And if we expose some of that in a way that it gets sees the light of day, we potentially help to unravel the rest of the corruption and expose more and other things that are going on. So this is a huge issue.
The tip of the iceberg,
but it's an enormous iceberg, and it's a very important one. So, you know, our cause isn't lost if he loses, but it potentially is helped tremendously if he wins. And I think it would hurt us. I am just excited that this is happening. I'm delighted that he's found an excellent attorney to take this on, a very experienced attorney, not one I'm familiar with personally, but has tremendous experience in the air, you know, to be able to take on this kind of a case. So he's in good hands, and we'll have to see how it goes. I would expect the response to this from the defendants will be an attempt to get it dismissed on one ground or another. Because
on a technicality,
case, on some kind of they'll look for a technicality, and that's common in the practice of law. If you can, you know, nip it in the bud, then you don't have to deal with all the time and trouble and expense of dealing with the facts. They're going to look for ways to make a legal argument to get the case dismissed, because if the case goes forward and it reaches what's called the discovery phase, which is where you start getting documents from one another, you know, we start getting the documents in front of a judge about what really went on in this matter. In a sense, this is an opportunity for him to retry the case that went on in England where he lost his license, because they are saying things that he now gets potentially has another opportunity to show. He's been accused and basically found guilty in Britain by the General Medical Council there for things. And the patients, the 12 children, their parents were not allowed to testify in the proceedings in the UK, which many people found just appalling. None of the parents complained. They thought he was a great doctor. They thought that the doctors they were working with were doing a terrific job. Nobody complained. It's this journalist who seems to be a front man for the pharmaceutical industry who has picked him apart and made a lot of false statements. It really concerns me that the British Medical Journal has jumped on board with all of this. But the journals are owned indirectly, if not directly, by the pharmaceutical industry. They control what gets published.
Are they the major advertisers?
Well, in some cases, they own them. They own the journals, you know, so directly or indirectly. The influence is overwhelming, but we have this is another subject that would be one that could explore it. But we have, I'll just give a quick example, Dr. Marcia, and I've probably mentioned this in past shows, Dr. Marcia Angel, Angel from Harvard University, who was a editor for the New England Journal of Medicine for over 20 years, went public in 2008 and said, we can no longer trust the medical literature and medical authorities because it's all driven by what profit and not by objective science. So, and she's not the only one who has spoken out of the mainstream field to make those kinds of comments. But we need more people to speak out so that this gets heard and acted on, rather than just becomes somebody who's a diminished or dismissive conspiracy theorist. But I encourage folks to go to the website and check out the link and read through this. This is a great action. I'm just really proud of Dr. Wakefield, excited this is going on, and wish him all the best luck. And we'll keep you posted on how this unfolds right here on Vaccines and Your Rights with Homeopathy World Community.
That sounds great. Good. Okay, let's move on to the GSK. That's the GlaxoSmithKline. When you say GSK, it really doesn't, unless people are familiar with that, it doesn't really impact you as much as hearing GlaxoSmithKline. Argentina Laboratories Company was fined, it says, 400,000 pesos, and in American dollars, oops, I got to go back, and I had that in there, but it's, hold on, 200,000?
Well, I saw an article, that said it was, they gave a figure of 93,000. I've seen that in one or two other articles.
Well,
so
200,000 is 46,000 U.S. dollars. So,
okay, have you got a conversion?
Yeah, I just converted it. So it's about a quarter of the number.
Okay, so maybe $100,000?
Well, 200,000, a quarter of that is 50,000.
Right, but they were fined 400,000 pesos.
Oh, 400,000?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's double the amount. So it's 100,000 U.S. dollars.
Yeah, so that 93,000 that I saw in another article is probably just based on a similar conversion rate, similar but different conversion rate. So we know the ballpark, though, somewhere in the vicinity of $100,000.
And this was because?
Because they didn't follow procedures, they didn't follow the law, and they ended up, 14 babies ended up dying in the process. And this is quite disturbing. GlaxoSmithKline, of course, is a major pharmaceutical company that manufactures vaccines. There's a particularly telling line in here somewhere where they talk about, boy, let me see if I can find it to give you exactly what it says here.
So they're getting fined for vaccine manufacturing. What are they specifically?
No, they are a manufacturer. This was a
irregularities during the lab. Okay.
They were charged with experimenting with human beings, falsifying parental authorizations so babies could participate in vaccine trials. And these were trials that were conducted, by the way, back in 2007 and 2008. And I probably, if I wrote 2011, I believe this is a 2012 article because it's only just been spread around. So I probably wrote 2011 out of reflex, and it's a 2012 article. Very recent article, so I'll apologize for that. There were 15,000 kids under the age of one in parts of Argentina, and they got parents. Now, and they make a point in this article of saying that they can't do these kind of studies in Europe and the U.S., and so they go to third world countries. Now, we've heard the third world country story before about how pharmaceutical companies will go to third world countries because they can usually they can bury the mistakes, and people say that as a really dark humor pun there, because they can bury the mistakes, but they have much more control when they're outside of the U.S. They're not following FDA guidelines. They're in a different country. They have much more control over this, but this is one case where they got caught. Now, one of the things that happened is that the parents they were working with, and often this is the case in third world countries, were illiterate, and they have this 28-page consent form. They don't know what they're signing, and that has come out in this. There was an issue that some parents tried to get out of it at some point for whatever reason. I don't think the article said why, but they were told no, they couldn't get out, or they wouldn't get any more vaccines if they got out, and so they were, you know, basically coerced or pressured into staying in, and they weren't following proper procedures, and 14 babies end up dying. And isn't it interesting that, you know, for something on the order of maybe $6,000 or $7,000 a piece, it's okay if, you know, babies die as long as you pay a few thousand dollars for each one of them. It's really quite disturbing that, first of all, that this would have occurred at all, but second of all, that when 14 babies die, the fine they get is on the order of $6,000 or $7,000 per baby. That is just awful. That's not going to discourage GSK from doing the same thing in the future. I mean, for God's sake, pharmaceutical industry fines routinely run in the hundreds of millions of dollars. It's not unusual at all for pharmacies to be get criminal and or civil fines in millions, even hundreds of millions of dollars. We had one pharmaceutical just a few weeks ago that got a combined criminal civil fine of $3 billion. Sometime early this year, they're going to apportion that and determine which part of that is considered criminal fine and what part of it's civil fine. But that's going to be the largest fine, single instance fine to date, but it's not at all uncommon for millions, tens, or even hundreds of millions of dollars to be in the fine. So here they're being fined, you know, roughly $100,000.
Is it a drop in the bucket for them? It doesn't mean very much, $100,000.
I don't see how it could. To me, this is a sneeze to them. You know, the billion-dollar fine that Pfizer got in 2009, billion-dollar criminal fine, along with a $1.3 billion civil fine for illegal marketing of drugs, that was probably, you know, that probably hurt. It was probably an ouch associated with that. But it's part of doing business for them. It has to be, because they keep doing these things over and over again. If it wasn't a net profit attached to all this, they wouldn't keep doing it. But this is just really disturbing. The people that we would want on the planet to be the most ethical and the most careful would be people in the medical field, healthcare. And yet it seems, perhaps because it's competitive and there's big money to be made and so forth, but whatever the reasons are, it seems that this is an arena where some of the worst ethics exist. As evidenced by cases like this. But I know the time is rolling on here.
Okay, you want to go to
there
the next...
For folks to move on. Yeah, let's keep on going here.
Okay, so that was good highlight. Now the next one is the FDA warns Novartis of violations at three plants. So
yeah,
this criminal activity is not only in one location. It covers the spectrum of different companies.
It really does, and what concerned me with this was not only was this, and this is a very short article, so we can cover this in just a minute or two here, but it's not just that there are violations at a plant somewhere. You know, that's going to happen from time to time. It's the nature of the violations here that concern me, and the fact that it's at three different plants with a single company, which makes you wonder, is this just the way the company does business generally? But real quick, here's what these had to do. They were... repeat observations, first of all, at three Novartis facilities. So it wasn't even something that they were hearing for the first time. The violations included failure to prevent microbiological contamination of sterile drug products. Failure to prevent microbiological contamination of sterile drug products. Failure to investigate out-of-specification batches. You know, if you have an out-of-specification batch, that means when you buy that drug, you're not getting what you think you get. You're not getting what you're paying for. You're not getting what the doctor prescribed you.
It's mislabeled.
Yes. Even if it's the generally correct drug, if it's out of specification. So you may be getting more or less or stronger or weaker or something not that you're paying for. That's disturbing. It's disturbing enough when you take pharmaceuticals and you are getting what you think you're getting.
Failure to clean and maintain equipment. Wow. So, you know, if it's not clean, you really don't know what's going into it. It could
be cockroaches
or something else. I don't know.
I mean, is this a cost-cutting measure, or is this just something that comes from sloppy management? But, you know, it almost doesn't matter, you know, for short-term purposes, because if the equipment's not clean, if the out-of-specification batches are not investigated, if they're not preventing contamination of the drug products, and then this last one they say here, failure to ensure drugs' identity, strength, quality, and purity, failure to identify strength, quality, and purity, I mean, how can you possibly rely on an industry that does this? Now, you know, you can talk about this article as an isolated instance, but I want to just repeat that these were, quote, several repeat observations and at three different facilities. Now, you attach this to something like the ongoing, you know, multi-billion dollar criminal and civil fines this industry gets every year, and those the total of those fines has been increasing over recent years. It paints a picture here that is very disturbing and should be information that people who rely on this system should be aware of so they can make informed decisions about whether they want to keep relying on it. So just another example there to point out what's going on here.
Okay, so that was a short little blurb, and then the next thing that we have coming up on the schedule is the details of the lab-made bird flu that is not going to be revealed. So, in other words, more that sun, the moon, and whatever the planets, it's the truth. It's not going to be revealed. Something is being hidden, and it's now going to come out into the light. And this is the details of the lab-made bird flu that won't be revealed, coming from Yahoo News. And it comes out of the AP. The United States government paid scientists to figure out how the deadly bird flu virus might mutate to become a bigger threat to people. And two labs succeeded in creating new strains that are easier to spread. Interesting, interesting. So we are creating our own pandemic flu vaccine, flus, strains. And so do they have something that they're going to give us the disease so that we can take their vaccine to stop the disease?
Well, there are lots of underlying ethical questions here, moral questions. You know, what in the world are we doing creating deadly pandemic viruses that didn't previously exist? You know, somebody said recently that nature is the worst bioterrorist, and I'm not sure that's true. That assumes things like the 1918 Spanish flu that allegedly killed 20 million people around the world was completely natural, and there's some evidence to suggest that it wasn't. But if nature was really the worst bioterrorist, I don't think the human species would have survived as well and as long as it has for through its millions of years of evolution. But in any case, this one, if we assume for a moment that it's valid to do this kind of research, and part of the argument in favor of doing this kind of research is, well, others are going to be doing it as well, developing bioterrorist weapons, and so we need to be ahead of the game to figure out how you can do that so that we can be prepared to develop ways to prevent or treat it and that sort of thing. I'm not saying that I'm necessarily endorse those arguments, but I can certainly understand people thinking in those ways. But the fact is they did the research and they came up now with, and here's the thing, bird flu is considered to be, and has been shown to be, at least according to some sources, a pretty virulent form of flu, a high mortality rate. That's the bad news. The good news is that it's not highly transmissible. And so if the bird flu were to mutate through some natural means to become highly transmissible among people, it could be a very, very serious problem. Now, bioterrorism research goes on around the world all the time. We're just not kept up to date on what everybody's doing. You know, that's going to be a matter of a secrecy for at least somewhat obvious reasons. So I'm sort of surprised that we heard about this research going on and the labs succeeding in this at all. But the question was, they came up with, they had this quote-unquote success, and the question was, should they be publishing this in medical journals? And the legitimate question about that, I think, is do you want to put that information out, and how much about what you did do you want to publish that anybody can then pick up and read and maybe use that information to help them in their own research, duplicating this, somebody who might want to unleash such a laboratory created
virus. So the reason that they do this is for bioterrorism. If they do that, they're creating these types of strains for warfare, biological warfare, or what is the purpose behind them doing it in the first place?
Well, to the best of my understanding, and I don't pretend to have a thorough or complete understanding of this by any means, but to the best of my understanding...
Are you still there?
I'm here. Are you there?
Yeah, I had a bunch of noise going on in the background. Okay, keep going.
Okay. To the best of my knowledge, at least part of the rationale for it is that they need to be a step ahead of everyone else. They need to know how to do this, if it can be done, maybe for offensive purposes, at least potentially or hypothetically, but also for defensive purposes. If they see what it takes to convert a non-threatening virus into a highly threatening virus, then they're going to be better equipped to, at least potentially, to develop treatments that would either treat or inhibit or undermine or in some way enable us to defend against such a bioterrorist weapon if we should be hit with it from an adversary.
You bring up a very important point, don't you? That if we can do it, they could be doing it, and which really brings up the point of all of these viruses that are floating around could potentially be human-made rather than simply natural flus that are coming through.
Well, there's some pretty compelling evidence, for example, that the 2009-2010 swine flu virus was man-made. There are people who have examined that and found, its DNA components or other genetic material that appears to come from four different viruses from different parts of the planet, and the odds of that happening naturally are very, very slim. So I'm not a scientist, but at least from a layperson's perspective, I find that a compelling argument, or at least it raises a very serious concern on my part. There's other information as well to suggest that the swine flu virus was man-made. As well, for example, with Ebola and some other things. So we have a lot more to fear than just nature, and probably more so from...
We have more to fear than fear itself.
When it comes to what people are doing.
we're living in a very frightening era that humans would even consider to do these horrendous types of crimes against other human beings. To think of the massive number of populations that could be affected. And it just blows my mind. I cannot conceive of wanting to hurt another person and why people... And the thing about it is something like this, you cannot... control. You cannot say, I'm just going to do this against my enemy. It's something that goes out of the limitations of a region. So I don't understand how the thinking behind that, it's not protecting you. I mean, how is the individual protected or your countrymen protected if you unleash something of this nature?
Well, we live in an age where people are, in some instances, willing to sacrifice themselves in order to take down their enemies or perceived enemies. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a bioterrorist weapon. Doesn't necessarily have to be something that only kills them and doesn't hurt us. You know, in that kind of mentality. the so-called suicide bombers or kamikaze pilots in World War II. I think it's a pretty desperate position, but there are obviously people who, whether they arrive at that position on their own or are brainwashed into it or whatever, there are people who arrive at that place in their thinking and are willing to act on it. So we're in a sort of a disturbing place here. But theoretically, if you have a bioterrorist weapon, you would want to use it in a way that it's not going to harm you, and that would mean that either you have a way to localize its effect or you have an antidote of some kind or a vaccine or equivalent kind of thing that keeps it from bothering you when it's hurting you, when it's going to hurt other people. So, but, you know, terrorists are not necessarily people who are going to be thinking in clear, rational terms. And also, terrorism may also be something that is something that is presented as being, there can be events that are presented as being terrorism that maybe really aren't events. Not everything that happens is what it appears to be. In fact, I would go so far as to say maybe most things that happen as presented on the 6 o'clock news anyway. You know, somebody recently said, if you want to know what's happening, watch the 6 o'clock news. That isn't it. And
well,
what
do you watch? You watch Twitter.
Well, you know, we're in a time when there is our disinformation is something that happens. It's an art. It's a practice. It's a skill. We have to be discerning and learn to be discerning and learn to look at different opposing views on things and look beneath the surface to figure out who's correct. There are probably few sources that are reliable 100% to always be accurate. So I try to always find at least two sources for any really critical piece of information, two credible sources, before I start to, you know, begin to rely on it with any in any sort of significant way. Just as sort of a general proposition here. Well, let me go on and mention one more thing that we can squeeze in here. We got just a couple more minutes, I think.
Yeah, we're covering a lot.
Yeah, we need to get. Fine-tune our technique here, Debbie, so we can do this more consistently, I think.
Great.
Because there's so much that goes on all the time in this arena. But this is a piece of good news. Let's finish on mildly good news anyway. It's an article titled, Physicians Oppose Mandatory Flu Vaccine for Health Workers. And I just can't give enough praise to the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, an organization that has taken a stand. In this case, I think we're double check here. I think we were in Colorado, but no, I'm sorry, maybe it's New Mexico. In any case, the AAPS. Now, since the swine flu pandemic of 2009-2010, hospitals around the country have been implementing mandatory flu vaccine and in some cases other vaccine requirements for their healthcare workers as a matter, for the most part, a matter of company policy as opposed to state law requirement. And there's the saying, get the shot or lose your job. And so I've been working with dozens of healthcare workers this past fall and last fall and winter who are saying, how do I avoid this? And there are some ways that they can legally avoid them, but it's really difficult. The AAPS has made some really great points here as to why there shouldn't be a mandate at all. There are, under law, some religious exceptions and medical exceptions, not specifically for vaccines in the workplace per se, but laws that allow people to object to vaccines for religious reasons, and then the employers have to reasonably accommodate them if they can. We've talked about that in the past, and we can get into that again in the future here. But the AAPS points out that the religious exemption is too narrowly drawn. It should be a philosophical exemption, as is accepted in many states, at least with regard to school exemptions. Now, I'll point out there are very few exemption laws in any state for healthcare workers, and only one state that has an exemption, philosophical exemption law for healthcare workers, and that's Maine. But so when they say in many states here, they're really referring to the school exemption laws. But they say to, and I love this line, quote, to avoid inquisitions into matters of faith, unquote. What we have right now going on around the country, and I know this from clients I've worked with around the country who are healthcare employees, hospitals that have different policies from hospital to hospital. We're talking about a federal law right that allows them to refuse for religious reasons. And there's just absolutely no way that even any one hospital is applying the appropriate legal criteria when they're deciding who does or doesn't qualify for a religious exemption and applying it consistently to every single employee I know that because most of the hospitals that I've been dealing with my clients don't even understand the legal boundaries of what does and doesn't qualify for religious exemption. So I know they're not using proper criteria when they're scrutinizing the exemption claims. I don't even think they have the legal authority to scrutinize them at all, but there
right.
is some lack of clarity in the law on that point, perhaps, giving them the benefit of the doubt.
So they're saying they want to get the exemption for religion out of there because it doesn't belong in church and mixing church and state, and who's going to define what this religion is, and rather make it a philosophical exemption across the board for everyone. And my question is, when you have to get vaccines, just like, you know, the people who sign you up for their group on Facebook, I didn't opt into that. And all of a sudden, I'm on somebody's Facebook group. How about something even more life, you know, changing is getting a vaccine? Shouldn't you have to opt into doing that rather than opt out?
Well, from a common sense point of view, yes. But employers, to a certain point, are free to decide whatever the criteria they want to have for their employees to be employed is, and unless you're in a state where you have a union, and you have, and in which case you get to bargain for the terms of employment, most healthcare workers are what are called at-will employees. The hospital can fire them at any time for no reason. They can decide what the criteria are to be employed with them.
Mm-hmm.
Now that even with private employers, the freedom they have for that is not unbounded. And even with private employers, if the hospital accepts Medicaid and Medicare, they still have to give you the constitutional rights still apply to them. See, the Constitution only applies to governments, but it can also apply to private entities if the private entity has ties to government, such as accepting state and federal funds with Medicaid and Medicare. So even the private hospitals have to follow the Constitution on this matter. And also we're talking about a federal law right, which would have to go by constitutional boundaries anyway. So, but hospitals don't always understand this. I'm seeing hospitals implement policy around the country without bothering to do the research, the legal research, to find out what the employee rights are and what the employer legal obligations are.
Somebody else has called in here, Alan. We don't know who it is.
I'd be glad to open it.
We have only one minute left. Let's see. Oh, and maybe it's Christina.
It's me.
Okay, good. All right. So Christina is in here. We're going to have a show coming up with her for pet health and hospice care. Maybe we should just end the show on a positive note that the physicians are speaking out. The Association of American Physicians and Surgeons are taking a closer look at vaccinations, rights, waivers, exemptions, who should or shouldn't have the ability to have a free choice and constitutional freedoms. Alan, you are fabulous every time you come on, and we're really getting good at this. We covered a lot of ground today, many, many important topics, and let's keep up that. Also, we want to talk about, just in the last minute, let people know that you have a vaccine exemptions and waivers guide, and they can get that from giving us a call. Just contact us, and we'll give you the information for that. What else do we want to tell on the last second?
Well, we're here every Thursday at noon. Greg Glazer will be back with us in the first or second Thursday of February. So please stay tuned. And, folks, you're welcome to call in during the show, or if the chat is set up, to send questions and messages that way, or contact me anytime at attorney@vaccinerights.com. Thanks a lot, Debbie. It's great having you back again. Look forward to seeing you next week.
We're going to end this show and then start up in one more minute, okay?
Yep, I'll call back in.
No, stay in.
Oh, I can stay
Alan
in?
Phillips,
yep.
And
oh, okay,
Brown.
I thought I had to call back.
On Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Think of us together, like people everywhere. We dream about a world at work where people